who wanted to divorce her husband because he could not satisfy her. She at times industriously solicited most of the magistrates to gain sympathy for her plight. After her husband was medically examined, however, she moved back in with him. The report of the physicians, who in form examined his abilities and allowed him in every respect to be sufficient, gave her but small satisfaction, Franklin wrote. Whether any experiments more satisfactory have been tried, we cannot say. But it seems she now declares it as her opinion that George is as good as the best. In another passing reference to sexual virility, which was also his first published notice of lightning, Franklin reported about a bolt that melted the pewter button on the pants of a young lad, adding, "'Tis well nothing else thereabouts was made of pewter." Writing as the casuist, Franklin even helped to pioneer the genre of sexual and moral advice columns. Although the literal definition of the word casuistry refers to the application of moral principles to everyday conduct, Franklin used it with a touch of irony in its more colloquial sense, which implies a slightly off-kilter or misleading application of those principles. One letter from a reader, or from Franklin pretending to be a reader, posed the following dilemma. Suppose a person discovers that his wife has been seduced by his neighbor, and suppose he has reason to believe that if he reveals this to his neighbor's wife, then she might agree to have sex with him. Is he justifiable in doing it? Franklin, writing as the casuist, gave an earnest answer. If the questioner were a Christian, he would know that he should return not evil for evil, but repay evil with good. And if he is not a Christian, but instead one who would make reason the rule of his actions, he would come to the same conclusion. Such practices can produce no good to society. Franklin also knew another maxim of journalism. Crime stories sell, particularly when they are outlandish. In a report on the death of a young girl, for example, he provided the mix of reporting and outrage later perfected by racier tabloids. The case involved a couple who were charged with murdering the man's daughter from a previous marriage by neglecting her, forcing her to lie and rot in her nastiness, giving her her own excrements to eat, and turning her out of doors. The child died, but a physician testified she would have died anyway from other ailments she had, so the judge sentenced the couple merely to be burned on the hand. Franklin raged at the pathetic ruling and delivered his own harsh verdict that the couple had not only acted contrary to the particular law of all nations, but had even broken the universal law of nature. A third reliable method of selling papers was through a light and rather innocent willingness to gossip and scandalmonger. In his first busybody essay for Bradford, Franklin had defended the value of nosiness and tattling. Now that he had his own paper, he made it clear that the Gazette was pleased, indeed proud, to continue this service. Using the same tone as the busybody, Franklin wrote an anonymous letter to his paper defending gossip, backbiting, and censure by showing its usefulness and the great good it does to society. It is frequently the means of preventing powerful, politic, ill-designing men from growing too popular, he wrote. All examining censure, with her hundred eyes and her thousand tongues, soon discovers, and as speedily divulges in all quarters, every least crime or foible that is part of their true character. This clips the wings of their ambition. Gossip can also, he noted, promote virtue, as some people are motivated more by fear of public humiliation than they are by inner moral principles. "What will the world say of me if I act thus?" is often a reflection strong enough to enable us to resist the most powerful temptation to vice or folly. This preserves the integrity of the wavering, the honesty of the covetous, the sanctity of some of the religious, and the chastity of all virgins. It is amusing that Franklin, though he was willing to impugn the innate resolve of all virgins, protected himself by impugning only some religious people. In addition, he showed a somewhat cynical side by implying that most people act virtuously not because of an inner goodness, but because they are afraid of public censure. The following week, Franklin defended the value of gossip in another letter, even more flavorful, purportedly penned by the aptly named Alice Addertongue. Franklin, who was then 26, had his fictional Alice identify herself, with an edge of irony, as a young girl of about 35. She lived at home with her mother, and she said, "Find it my duty as well as inclination to exercise my talent at censure for the good of my country folks." After taking a swipe at a silly piece in Bradford's Mercury that criticized women for being gossipy, Alice recounts how she once found herself at odds with her mother on this issue. "She argued that scandal spoiled all good conversation, and I insisted without it there could be no such thing. As a result, she was banished to the kitchen when visitors came for tea. While her mother engaged guests in high-minded discourse in the parlor, Alice regaled a few young friends with tales of a neighbor's intrigue with his maid. Hearing the laughter, her mother's friends began drifting from the parlor into the kitchen to partake in the gossip. Her mother finally joined them. 'I have long thought that if you would make your paper a vehicle of scandal, you would double the number of your subscribers.'" Franklin's playful defenses of busybodies, among the most amusing pieces he ever wrote, set a light-hearted tone for his paper. Because of his gregarious personality and fascination with human nature, he appreciated tales about people's foibles and behavior, and he understood why others did as well. But he was, of course, only half serious in his defense of gossip. The other part of his personality was more earnest. He continually resolved to speak ill of nobody. As a result, he toyed in the Gazette with the argument for gossip, but he did not really indulge in it much. For example, in one issue he noted that he had gotten a letter describing the disagreements and conduct of a certain couple, but for charitable reasons the said letter is at present thought not fit to be published. Likewise, he was ambiguous when writing about drinking. He was a temperate man, who nevertheless enjoyed the joviality of taverns. In one famous Gazette piece, destined to become a poster in countless pubs, he produced a drinker's dictionary, listing 250 or so synonyms for being drunk. Addled, afflicted, biggy, boozy, busky, buzzy, cherubimical, cracked, halfway to Concord. Yet he also frightened readers with colorful news accounts of the deaths of drunks, and he wrote editorials on the poisonous effect of spirits. As a printer in London, he had lectured co-workers that strong drink made them less industrious. As an editor in Philadelphia, he continued this crusade. Franklin also perfected the art of poking fun at himself. He realized, as have subsequent American humorists, that a bit of wry self-deprecation could make him seem more endearing. In one small item in the Gazette, he recounted how a certain printer was walking along the wharf when he slipped and stuck his leg into a barrel of tar. His awkward escape resembled the saying about being as nimble as a bee in a tar barrel. Franklin ended the item with a little play on words. 'Tis true he was no honey bee, nor yet a humble bee, but a boo bee he may be allowed to be, namely, B.F. By the early 1730s, Franklin's business was thriving. He started building an extended little empire by sending his young workers, once they had served their time with him, to set up partnership shops in places ranging from Charleston to Hartford. He would supply the presses and part of the expenses, as well as some content for the publications, and in return take a portion of the revenue. A practical marriage. Now that he had established himself in business, Franklin found himself in want of a good wife. Bachelorhood was frowned on in colonial America, and Franklin had a sexual appetite that he knew required discipline. So he set out to find himself a mate, preferably one with a dowry attached. Boarding at his house was a friend from the Junto, glazier and mathematician Thomas Godfrey, and his wife, who tended to their meals and homemaking. Mrs. Godfrey proposed a match with one of her nieces, whom Franklin found very deserving, and a courtship ensued. Dowries being common, Franklin sought to negotiate his through Mrs. Godfrey. Approximately £100, the amount he still owed on his printing business. When the girl's family replied that they could not spare that much, Franklin suggested, rather unromantically, that they could mortgage their home. The girl's family promptly broke off the relationship, either out of outrage or, as Franklin suspected, in the hope that the courtship had gone so far that they would elope without a dowry. Resentful, Franklin refused to have anything more to do with the girl, even after Mrs. Godfrey suggested they were open to negotiations. Not only did the courtship end, so did yet another Franklin friendship. Godfrey moved out, quit the Junto, and eventually turned over the printing of his little almanac to Franklin's competitor Bradford. Years later, Franklin wrote dismissively about the man who once shared his house, club, and presumably affection. Godfrey was not a pleasing companion, as, like most great mathematicians I have met with, he expected unusual precision in everything said, or was forever denying or distinguishing upon trifles, to the disturbance of all conversation. Franklin's annoyance also led him to satirize the situation in the Gazette not long thereafter, using the pseudonym Anthony Afterwit. The honest tradesman complains that when he was courting his wife, her father hinted that he could be in for a nice dowry, and he formed several fine schemes of how to spend the money. When the old gentleman saw I was pretty well engaged and that the match was too far gone to be easily broke off, he forbid me the house and told his daughter that if she married me, he would not give her a farthing. Afterwit, unlike the real Franklin, elopes. I have since learned that there are old curmudgeons besides him who have this trick to marry their daughters and yet keep what they might well spare. The Anthony Afterwit essay had an interesting side effect. His fictional wife, Abigail Afterwit, was the name of a character that had been created almost a decade earlier by Franklin's estranged brother, James, in the New England Courant. James, who had since moved to Rhode Island, reprinted the Anthony Afterwit piece in his own paper, along with a reply from a Patience Teacraft. Benjamin, in turn, reprinted the reply in his Philadelphia paper, and the following year he visited his brother for an emotional reconciliation. James's health was failing, and he begged his younger brother to look after his 10-year-old son. That Benjamin did, arranging for his education and taking him on as an apprentice. A dominant theme in Franklin's autobiography is that of making mistakes and then making amends, as if he were a moral bookkeeper balancing his accounts. Running away from his brother was, Franklin noted, one of the first errata of my life. Helping James's son was the way to set the ledger back into balance. Thus it was that I made my brother ample amends for the service I had deprived him of by leaving him so early. After his courtship of Mrs. Godfrey's niece was scuttled, Franklin scouted around for other possible brides. But he discovered that young printers were not valued enough to command a sure dowry. He could not expect money unless it was to marry a woman I should not otherwise think agreeable. In his autobiography, which he began years later as a letter to the illegitimate son he fathered while looking for a wife, Franklin wrote a memorable line. In the meantime, that hard-to-be-governed passion of youth had hurried me frequently into intrigues with low women that fell in my way, which were attended with some expense and great inconvenience. Deborah Reed, the girl who had laughed at him when he first straggled into Philadelphia, was also in a rather desperate situation. After Franklin left her to live in London, she had received only one curt letter from him. So she made the mistake of marrying a charming but unreliable potter named John Rogers. He was unable to make a living, and Deborah soon heard rumors that he had abandoned a wife in England. So she moved back in with her mother, and Rogers stole a slave and absconded to the West Indies, leaving behind a load of debt. Although there were reports he had died there in a brawl, these were unconfirmed, which meant Deborah would have difficulty legally remarrying. Bigamy was a crime punishable by 39 lashes and life imprisonment. Since the death of Deborah's father, her mother had been eking out a living by selling homemade medicines. An advertising bill, printed by Franklin, notes, "The widow Reed continues to make and sell her well-known ointment for the itch, with which she has cured abundance of people. It also kills or drives away all sorts of lice in once or twice using." Franklin frequently visited the Reeds, advised them on business matters, and took pity on the dejected Deborah. He faulted himself for her plight, though Mrs. Reed kindly took most of the blame for not having let them marry before he left for London. Fortunately for all, according to Franklin, our mutual affection was revived. Around that time, Franklin developed a method for making difficult decisions. "My way is to divide a sheet of paper by a line into two columns, writing over the one pro and the other con," he later recalled. Then he would list all the arguments on each side and weigh how important each was. "Where I find two, one on each side, that seem equal, I strike them both out. If I find a reason pro equal to some two reasons con, I strike out the three." By this bookkeeper's calculus, it became clear to him where the balance lies. However exactly he came to his decision, the balance of considerations eventually tipped toward Deborah, and in September 1730 they began living together as a married couple. There was no official ceremony. Instead, they entered into a type of common law arrangement that served to protect them from charges of bigamy if Rogers unexpectedly reappeared. But he never did. Franklin viewed his union with Deborah, like his reconciliation with his brother, as an example of his rectifying an earlier error. "Thus I corrected that great erratum as well as I could," Franklin later wrote of his mistreatment of the younger Deborah. Franklin is often described as, or accused of, being far more practical than romantic, a man of the head rather than heart. The tale of his common-law marriage to Deborah provides some support for this view, but it also illustrates some complexities of Franklin's character. His desire to tame his hard-to-govern passions by being practical, and the genuine fondness he felt for kindred companions. He was not given to starry-eyed, soulful commitments or poetic love. Instead, his emotional attachments tended to be the more prosaic bonds of affection that grew out of partnership, self-interest, collaboration, camaraderie, and good-humored kinship. A wife who brought with her a dowry would have likely also brought expensive social airs and aspirations. Instead, Franklin found a good and faithful helpmate who was frugal and practical and devoid of pretensions, traits that he later noted were far more valuable to a rising tradesman. Their union remained mutually useful, if not deeply romantic, until Deborah's death 44 years later. As Franklin would soon have poor Richard pronounce in his almanac, "Keep your eyes wide open before marriage, half shut afterwards." William. There was one major complication facing the new marriage. Around that time, Franklin fathered and took sole custody of an illegitimate son named William, which was probably the great inconvenience that he coldly wrote in his autobiography was the result of consorting with low women. The identity of William's mother is one of history's delicious mysteries, a source of speculation among scholars. Franklin never revealed the secret, nor did William, if he knew. In fact, even the date of his birth is unclear. Let's start there. Most historians say that William was born sometime between April 12, 1730, and April 12, 1731. This is based on a letter Franklin wrote to his own mother on April 12, 1750, referring to William as "now 19 years of age, a tall, proper youth, and much of a beau." Willard Stern Randall, in A Little Revenge, a fascinating but somewhat speculative account of Franklin's troubled relationship with his son, questions this. In September 1746, William left home with an ensign's commission on a military expedition to Canada, and Randall argues that he was unlikely to have been only 15 or 16. Perhaps, in writing his mother, Franklin was shaving a year or two off William's age to make him seem legitimate. Likewise, the meticulous Franklin scholar J. A. Leo LeMay, on his website detailing Franklin's life, surmises he was born in 1728 or 1729, as do some 19th century biographers. However, we know that before he was allowed to enlist, perhaps sometime in early 1746, William tried to run away to sea, and his father had to fetch him home from a ship in the harbor, which indicates that he indeed might not have been any older than 15 or 16 at the time. His father had considered running off to sea at age 12 and did run away to Philadelphia at 17. Sheila Skemp's comprehensive biography of William makes it seem quite logical that he embarked with the military at 16, well after he finished his schooling. In addition, William was responsible for the belief reported in a magazine that he was 82 when he died in 1813, which would place his birth in late 1730 or early 1731. On balance, because neither man ever denied William's illegitimacy, it makes sense to believe that Franklin was telling the truth to his mother when he referred to William's age. And it makes equal sense to believe that William was never, intentionally or not, misleading about his age. Based on these assumptions, it is likely that William was born around the time that Deborah began living with Franklin in late 1730. That being the case, might Deborah actually have been his mother, as some scholars speculate? Might the common law marriage have been partly occasioned by her pregnancy? While William's origin was left murky in case Rogers reappeared and charged her with bigamy and adultery. As Carl Van Doren muses, there was bound to be a scandal, but of course it would be less if the child appeared to be Franklin's and an unknown mother's. The lusty philosopher could take all the blame. But this theory doesn't bear much scrutiny. If Deborah had been pregnant and given birth, there would surely be some friends and relatives, including her mother, who would have known. As H.W. Brands puts it, even after the passage of years precluded any further concerns about Rogers, Debbie declined to claim William as her own, an omission impossible to imagine in any mother, let alone one who had to watch from close at hand while her son spent his life labeled a bastard. On the contrary, she was openly hostile to him. According to a clerk who later worked for the Franklins, Deborah referred to William as the greatest villain upon earth, and heaped upon him invectives in the foulest terms I ever heard from a gentlewoman. During a heated election in 1764, William's paternity became an issue. One abusive pamphlet charged that he was the son of a prostitute named Barbara, who was subsequently exploited by the Franklins as a maid until she died and was buried in an unmarked grave. Given the scurrilous nature of that campaign, and the unlikelihood that any of the Franklins could have abided having William's real mother around as their maid, this also seems implausible. The best explanation comes from a 1763 letter about William, rediscovered more than two centuries later, which was written by George Roberts, a prosperous Philadelphia merchant who was a close family friend. "'Tis generally known here his birth is illegitimate and his mother not in good circumstances,' Roberts wrote to a friend in London. "'But the report of her begging bread in the streets of this city is without the least foundation in truth. I understand some small provision is made by him for her, but her being none of the most agreeable women prevents particular notice being shown, or the father and son acknowledging any connection with her.' As Roberts was probably in a position to know, and as he had no ulterior motive, we are left with this as the likeliest scenario. A Frugal Mate. In his autobiography, which extols the virtues of industry and frugality a total of 36 times, Franklin wrote of his wife, "It was lucky for me that I had one as much disposed to industry and frugality as myself." He gives her even more credit in a letter written later, near the end of his life. "Frugality is an enriching virtue, a virtue I could never acquire in myself, but I was lucky enough to find it in a wife, who thereby became a fortune to me." For Franklin, this passed for true love. Deborah helped at the print shop, stitched pamphlets, and purchased rags for papermaking. At least initially they had no servants, and Franklin ate his bread and milk porridge each morning from a twopenny bowl. In later years, after a conflicted Franklin had developed some taste for finery, while still clinging to his admiration for frugality, he wryly recounted a little lapse on Deborah's part that showed how luxury will enter families and make a progress in spite of principle. One day he arrived at breakfast to find it served in a china bowl with a silver spoon. Deborah had bought them at the enormous sum of 23 shillings, with no other excuse or apology to make but that she thought her husband deserved a silver spoon and china bowl as well as any of his neighbors. With a droll mix of pride and disdain, Franklin recalled how over many years, as their wealth grew, they ended up with china and furnishings worth several hundred pounds. When the young Franklin heard that his little sister Jane was planning to marry, he wrote her a letter that reflected his view that a good wife should be frugal and industrious. He had thought about sending her a tea table, he said, but his practical nature got the better of him. "When I consider that the character of a good housewife was far preferable to that of being only a pretty gentlewoman, I concluded to send you a spinning wheel." As poor Richard would soon phrase it in his first almanac, "Many estates are spent in the getting, since women for tea forsook spinning and knitting." The virtue of frugality was also one of young Franklin's favorite themes in his newspaper writings. In Anthony Afterwit's letter, after complaining about having to elope with no dowry, he goes on to ridicule his wife for adopting the airs and spending habits of a gentlewoman. First, she pays for a fancy mirror, which then requires a nice table under it, then a tea service, and then a clock. Facing mounting debts, Anthony decides to sell these things when his wife leaves town to visit relatives. To replace the fancy furniture, he buys a spinning wheel and some knitting needles. He asks the Gazette to publish the letter so that she will read it before she returns and thus be prepared. "If she can conform to this new scheme of living, we shall be the happiest couple perhaps in the province." And then, as a reward, he might let her have the nice mirror back. Less sexist than most men of his day, Franklin also aimed his barbs at men. Afterwit's letter was answered 2 weeks later by one from another Franklin creation, Celia Single. With the delightful, gossipy voice of his other female characters, such as Silence Do-Good and Alice Addertongue, Single recounts a visit to a friend whose husband is trying to replicate Afterwit's approach. A raucous argument ensues. "There is neither sin nor shame in knitting a pair of stockings," the husband says. She replies, "There are poor women enough in town that can knit." Single finally leaves, knowing that a man and his wife are apt to quarrel more violently when before strangers than when by themselves. She later hears that the knitting thread ended up in the fireplace. Single, or rather Franklin, goes on to admonish Franklin for publishing more tales of self-indulgent women than men. "If I were disposed to be censorious, I could furnish you with instances enough," she says, then proceeds to rattle off a long list of men who waste their time playing pool, dice, or checkers, and buying fancy clothes. Finally, Franklin has her cleverly poke at his veil of pseudonymity. "There are holes enough to be picked in your coat as well as others, and those who are affronted by the satires you may publish will not consider so much who wrote as who printed." On a more serious and less modern note, Franklin published 4 weeks after he married, Rules and Maxims for Promoting Matrimonial Happiness. He began with a paean to marriage, the surest and most lasting foundation of comfort and love. However, the folly of some who enter into it often makes it a state of the most exquisite wretchedness and misery. He apologized for aiming his advice at women, as men were in fact more faulty. But the reason is because I esteem them better disposed to receive and practice it. Among his rules, avoid all thoughts of managing your husband. Never deceive him or make him uneasy. Accept that he is a man, not an angel. Resolve every morning to be good-natured and cheerful. Remember the word obey in your marriage vows. Do not dispute with him. And deny yourself the trivial satisfaction of having your own will. A woman's power and happiness, Franklin wrote, has no other foundation than her husband's esteem and love. Therefore, a wife should share and soothe his cares, and with the utmost diligence conceal his infirmities. And when it comes to sex, let the tenderness of your conjugal love be expressed with such decency, delicacy, and prudence as that it may appear plainly and thoroughly distinct from the designing fondness of a harlot. Franklin's essays and fictional letters make it clear that he entered into his union with Deborah holding some traditional views on matrimony. Wives should be supportive. Households should be run frugally and industriously. Fortunately for him, Deborah tended to share those views. In general, she had plain tastes, a willingness to work, and a desire to please her spouse. Of course, as he might have pointed out, the same could be said of him at the time. And so they settled into a partnership that was both more and less than a conventional marriage. A tireless collaborator, both in the house and at work, Deborah handled most of the accounts and expanded their shop's inventory to include ointments made by her mother, Crown soap made by Franklin's Boston relatives, coffee, tea, chocolate, saffron, cheese, fish, and various other sundries. She strained her eyes binding books and sewing clothes by candlelight. And though her spelling and choice of words reflected her lack of education, the sexton of the church was noted as the Seckstone, S-E-C-K-S-T-O-N-E. And one customer was called Mary the Papist. Her copious entries in their shop book are a delightful record of the times. Franklin's affection for her grew from his pride at her industry. Many years later, when he was in London arguing before the House of Commons that unfair taxes would lead to boycotts of British manufacturers, he asserted that he had never been prouder than when he was a young tradesman and wore only clothes that had been made by his wife. But Deborah was not merely a submissive or meek partner to the man she so often addressed, as he did her, as my dear child, and whom she sometimes publicly called Pappy. She had a fierce temper, which Franklin invariably defended. "Don't you know that all wives are in the right?" he asked a nephew who was having a dispute with Deborah. Soon after their marriage, he wrote a piece called A Scolding Wife, in which he defended assertive women by saying they tended to be active in the business of the family, special good housewives, and very careful of their husbands' interests. The only extant painting of Deborah makes her appear to be a sensible and determined woman, plump and plain, but not unattractive. In a letter he wrote her years later from London, he described a mug he was sending and compared it to her. I fell in love with it at first sight, for I thought it looked like a fat, jolly dame, clean and tidy, with a neat blue and white calico gown on, good-natured and lovely, and just put me in mind of somebody. It was a relationship that did not inspire great romantic verse, but it did produce an endearing ballad that he put into the mouth of poor Richard. In it, Franklin paid tribute to my plain country Joan, and blessed the day he made her his own. Among the lyrics, not a word of her shape, or her face, or her eyes, of flames or of darts shall you hear. Though I beauty admire, 'tis virtue I prize, which fades not in 70 years. In peace and good order my household she guides, right careful to save what I gain, yet cheerfully spends and smiles on the friends I've the pleasure to entertain. The best have some faults, and so has my Joan, but then they're exceedingly small. And now I'm used to 'em. They're so like my own. I can scarcely feel them at all. Over the years, Franklin would outgrow Deborah in many ways. Though they shared values, he was far more worldly and intellectual than she was or ever wanted to be. There is some evidence that she may have been born in Birmingham and brought to America as a young child, but during her adult life she seems never to have spent a night away from Philadelphia, and she lived most of her life on Market Street within 2 blocks of the house where she was raised. Franklin, on the other hand, loved to travel. And although he would, in later years, occasionally express some hope that she would accompany him, he knew that she was not so inclined. He seemed to sense that she would not be socially comfortable in his new realms. So, in this regard, they respected each other's independence, perhaps to a fault. For 15 of the last 17 years of Deborah's life, Franklin would be away, including when she died. Nevertheless, their mutual affection, respect, and loyalty, and their sense of partnership, would endure. Francis. 2 years into their marriage, in October 1732, Deborah gave birth to a son. Francis Folger Franklin, known as Frankie, was doted on by both parents. He had his portrait painted when still a baby, and his father advertised for a tutor to teach both his children when Francis was 2 and William about 4. For the rest of his life, Franklin would marvel at the memory of how precocious, curious, and special Frankie was. These were, alas, destined to be only sorrowful memories. In one of the few searing tragedies of Franklin's life, Frankie died of smallpox just after his 4th birthday. On his grave, Franklin chose a simple epitaph: the delight of all who knew him. The bitter irony was that Franklin had become a fervent advocate of smallpox vaccinations after they had been ridiculed in the New England Courant when Franklin worked there for his brother. In the years preceding Frankie's birth, he had editorialized in the Pennsylvania Gazette in support of inoculations and published statistics showing how effective they were. In 1730, for example, he wrote an account of a Boston epidemic in which most people who had been vaccinated were spared. He had planned to inoculate Frankie, but he had delayed doing so because the boy had been ill with the flux. In a sad announcement that appeared in his paper a week after the boy's death, Franklin denied rumors that he died from being vaccinated. I do hereby sincerely declare that he was not inoculated, but received the distemper in the common way of infection. He went on to declare his belief that inoculation was a safe and beneficial practice. The memory of Frankie was one of the few things ever to cause Franklin painful reflections. When his sister Jane wrote to him in London years later with happy news about his grandsons, Franklin responded that it brings often afresh to my mind the idea of my son Frankie, though now dead 36 years, whom I have seldom since seen equaled in everything, and whom to this day I cannot think of without a sigh. Adding to the poignancy, Franklin had written for his paper, while Frankie was still alive, an unusually deep rumination on the death of infants, which was occasioned by the death of a neighbor's child. Drawing on his observation of the tiny Frankie, he described the magical beauty of babies. What curious joints and hinges on which limbs are moved to and fro! What an inconceivable variety of nerves, veins, arteries, fibers, and little invisible parts are found in every member! What endless contrivances to secure life, to nourish nature, and to propagate the same to future animals! How could it be, Franklin then asked, that a good and merciful Creator should produce myriads of such exquisite machines to no other end or purpose but to be deposited in the dark chambers of the grave before they were old enough to know good from evil or to serve their fellow man and their God? The answer, he admitted, was beyond our mortal ken to understand. When nature gave us tears, she gave us leave to weep. Defining his God. When we last took Franklin's spiritual pulse in London, he had written his ill-conceived dissertation on liberty and necessity, which attacked the idea of free will and much of Calvinist theology, and then he had repudiated the pamphlet as an embarrassing erratum. That left him in a religious quandary. He no longer believed in the received dogmas of his Puritan upbringing, which taught that man could achieve salvation only through God's grace rather than through good works. But he was uncomfortable embracing a simple and unenhanced version of deism, the Enlightenment-era creed that reason and the study of nature, instead of divine revelation, tell us all we can know about our Creator. The deists he knew, including his younger self, had turned out to be squirrely in their morals. On his return to Philadelphia, Franklin showed little interest in organized religion, and even less in attending Sunday services. Still, he continued to hold some basic religious beliefs, among them the existence of the deity, and that the most acceptable service of God was doing good to man. He was tolerant toward all sects, particularly those that worked to make the world a better place, and he made sure to avoid all discourse that might tend to lessen the good opinion another might have of his own religion. Because he believed that churches were useful to the community, he paid his annual subscription to support the town's Presbyterian minister, the Reverend Jedediah Andrews. One day, Andrews prevailed on him to sample his Sunday sermons, which Franklin did for 5 weeks. Unfortunately, he found them uninteresting and unedifying, since not a single moral principle was inculcated or enforced, their aim seeming to be rather to make us good Presbyterians than good citizens. On his final visit, the reading from the Scripture, Philippians 4th chapter, 8th verse, related to virtue. It was a topic dear to Franklin's heart, and he hoped that Andrews would expound on the concept in his sermon. Instead, the minister focused only on dogma and doctrine, without offering any practical thoughts about virtue. Franklin was disgusted, and he reverted to spending his Sundays reading and writing on his own. Franklin began to clarify his religious beliefs through a series of essays and letters. In them, he adopted a creed that would last the rest of his life, a virtuous, morally fortified, and pragmatic version of deism. Unlike most pure deists, he concluded that it was useful, and thus probably correct, to believe that a faith in God should inform our daily actions. But, like other deists, his faith was devoid of sectarian dogma, burning spirituality, deep soul-searching, or a personal relationship to Christ. The first of these religious essays was a paper, for my own private use, written in November 1728, entitled Articles of Belief and Acts of Religion. Unlike his London dissertation, which was clogged with convoluted imitations of analytic philosophy, it was elegant and sparse. He began with a simple affirmation. I believe there is one supreme, most perfect being. It was an important statement, because some mushier deists shied even from going that far. As Diderot once quipped, a deist is someone who has not lived long enough to become an atheist. Franklin lived very long, and despite the suspicions of John Adams and others that he was a closet atheist, he repeatedly and indeed increasingly asserted his belief in a supreme God. In the deist tradition, Franklin's supreme being was somewhat distant and uninvolved in our daily travails. I imagine it great vanity in me to suppose that the supremely perfect does in the least regard such an inconsiderable nothing as man, he wrote. He added his belief that this infinite Father was far above wanting our praise or prayers. There is in all humans, however, a desire and a deeply felt duty to worship a more intimate God, Franklin surmised. Therefore, he wrote, the Supreme Being causes there to be lesser and more personal gods for mortal men to worship. Franklin thus has it both ways, combining the deist concept of God as a distant first cause with the belief of other religions that worship a God who is directly involved in people's lives. The result is a supreme being that can be manifest in various ways, depending on the needs of different worshipers. Some commentators, most notably A. Owen Aldridge, read this literally as Franklin's embracing some sort of polytheism, with a bevy of lesser gods overseeing various realms and planets. Occasionally, throughout his life, Franklin would refer to the gods, but these later references are quite casual and colloquial, and Franklin seems to be speaking more figuratively than literally in his 1728 paper. As Carey Walters writes in Benjamin Franklin and His Gods, it is an error to presume they point to a literal polytheism. Such a conclusion is as philosophically bizarre as it is textually unwarranted. Given the difficulties Franklin sometimes seems to have in believing in one God, it seems unlikely he could find himself believing in many. Franklin went on to outline how he viewed and worshipped his own personal God. This involved offering suitable prayers, and Franklin produced a whole liturgy that he had composed. It also required acting virtuously, and Franklin engaged in a moral calculus that was very pragmatic and even somewhat utilitarian. I believe he is pleased and delights in the happiness of those he has created, and since without virtue man can have no happiness in this world, I firmly believe he delights to see me virtuous. In a paper he subsequently read to his friends in the Junto, Franklin elaborated his religious beliefs by exploring the issue of divine providence, the extent to which God gets involved in worldly matters. The Puritans believed in a detailed and intimate involvement, called special providence, and regularly prayed to God for very specific intercessions. As Calvin himself put it, "Supposing that he remains tranquilly in heaven without caring for the world, outrageously deprives God of all effective power." Most deists, on the other hand, believed in a general providence, in which God expresses his will through the laws of nature he set in motion, instead of by micromanaging our daily lives. As was typical, Franklin sought a pragmatic resolution in his Junto talk, which he called On the Providence of God in the Government of the World. He began by apologizing to my intimate pot companions for being rather unqualified to speak on spiritual matters. His study of nature, he said, convinced him that God created the universe and was infinitely wise, good, and powerful. He then explored four possibilities. 1. God predetermined and predestined everything that happens, eliminating all possibility of free will. 2. He left things to proceed according to natural laws and the free will of his creatures and never interferes. 3. He predestined some things and left some things to free will, but still never interferes. 4. He sometimes interferes by his particular providence and sets aside the effects which would otherwise have been produced by any of the above causes. Franklin ended up settling on the fourth option, but not because he could prove it. Instead, it resulted from a process of elimination and a sense of which belief would be most useful for people to hold. Any of the first three options would mean that God is not infinitely powerful or good or wise. We are then necessarily driven into the fourth supposition, he wrote. He admitted that many find it contradictory to believe both that God is infinitely powerful and that men have free will. It was the conundrum that stymied him in the London dissertation he wrote and then renounced. But if God is indeed all-powerful, Franklin reasoned, he surely is able to find a way to give the creatures he made in his image some of his free will. Franklin's conclusion had, as might be expected, practical consequences. People should love God and pray to him for his favor and protection. He did not, however, stray too far from deism. He placed little faith in the use of prayers for specific personal requests or miracles. In an irreverent letter he later wrote to his brother John, he calculated that 45 million prayers were offered in all of New England seeking victory over a fortified French garrison in Canada. If you do not succeed, I fear I shall have but an indifferent opinion of Presbyterian prayers in such cases as long as I live. Indeed, in attacking strong towns, I should have more dependence on works than on faith. Above all, Franklin's beliefs were driven by pragmatism. The final sentence of his Junto talk stressed that it was socially useful for people to believe in the version of divine providence and free will that he proposed. This religion will be a powerful regulator of our actions, give us peace and tranquility within our own minds, and render us benevolent, useful, and beneficial to others. Not all of Franklin's religious musings were this earnest. Around the time of his Junto paper, he wrote for his newspaper a tale called A Witch Trial at Mount Holly, which was a delightful parody of Puritan mystical beliefs clashing with scientific experimentation. The accused witches were to be subjected to two tests, weighed on a scale against the Bible, and tossed in the river with hands and feet bound to see if they floated. They agree to submit to these tests on the condition that two of the accusers take the same test. With colorful details of all the ridiculous pomp, Franklin described the process. The accused and accusers all succeed in outweighing the Bible. But both of the accused and one of the accusers fail to sink in the river, thus indicating that they are witches. The more intelligent spectators conclude from this that most people naturally float. The others are not so sure, and they resolve to wait until summer, when the experiment could be tried with the subjects unclothed. Franklin's free thinking unnerved his family. When his parents wrote of their concern over his erroneous opinions, Franklin replied with a letter that spelled out a religious philosophy based on tolerance and utility that would last his life. It would be vain, he wrote, for any person to insist that all the doctrines he holds are true and all he rejects are false. The same could be said of the opinions of different religions as well. They should be evaluated, the young pragmatist said, by their utility. I think opinions should be judged by their influences and effects. And if a man holds none that tend to make him less virtuous or more vicious, it may be concluded that he holds none that are dangerous, which I hope is the case with me. He had little use for the doctrinal distinctions his mother worried about. I think vital religion has always suffered when orthodoxy is more regarded than virtue. And the Scripture assures me that at the last day we shall not be examined by what we thought, but what we did, that we did good to our fellow creatures. See Matthew, chapter 26. His parents, a bit more versed in the Scripture, probably caught that he meant Matthew chapter 25. They did, nonetheless, eventually stop worrying about his heresies. The Moral Perfection Project. Franklin's historical reputation has been largely shaped for disciples and detractors alike by his account in his autobiography of the famous project he launched to attain moral perfection. This rather odd endeavor, which involved sequentially practicing a list of virtues, seems at once so earnest and mechanical that one cannot help either admiring him or ridiculing him. As the novelist D.H. Lawrence later sneered, he made himself a list of virtues which he trotted inside like a gray nag in a paddock. So it's important to note the hints of irony and self-deprecation in his droll recollection, written when he was 79, of what he wryly dubbed the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection. His account has touches of the amused by his younger self tone to be found in the diverting little tales he wrote in France at the same time that he was writing this part of his autobiography. Yet it should also be noted that as a young man, he seemed to approach his moral perfection program with an endearing sincerity, and even as an old man seemed proud of its worthiness. Franklin began his quest around the time he ended his unsatisfactory visits to Presbyterian services and started spelling out his own religious creed. The endeavor was typically pragmatic. It contained no abstract philosophizing nor any reference to religious doctrines. As he later noted with pride, it was not merely an exhortation to be virtuous. It was also a practical guide on how to achieve that goal. First, he made a list of 12 virtues he thought desirable, and to each he appended a short definition. Temperance. Eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. Silence. Speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation. Order. Let all your things have their places. Let each part of your business have its time. Resolution. Resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. Frugality. Make no expense but to do good to others or yourself. That is, waste nothing. Industry. Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions. Sincerity. Use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly, and if you speak, speak accordingly. Justice. Wrong none by doing injuries or omitting the benefits that are your duty. Moderation. Avoid extremes. Forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. Cleanliness. Tolerate no uncleanliness in body, clothes, or habitation. Tranquility. Be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents common or unavoidable. Chastity. Rarely use venery but for health or offspring, never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation.